This is Dr. John Tempty at the University of Wisconsin, and also serving as chair of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and would like to welcome everyone on our phone bridge to this interim meeting of the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. I'm going to turn the conversation over to Dr. Larry Pickering for some brief announcements, and then we will move on to roll call of the ACIP members. Dr. Pickering?
Yes, thank you, John. Good afternoon and welcome to this interim meeting of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. This meeting will address use of 13-valent pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, PCV13, and 23-valent polysaccharide pneumococcal vaccine, PPSV23, in adults. The proceedings of this meeting are accessible only by phone and by web. Following the presentation, there will be time for public comment before a vote is taken by ACIP voting members. We hope to adjourn at 4 o'clock. It's a very tight schedule. Slides presented at this meeting will be posted on the APIC website within the next 2 weeks. Meeting minutes are generally posted within 90 days of a meeting. Members of the press who are interested in conducting interviews with ACIP members should contact Allison Albert for assistance in arranging these interviews. Allison can be reached at 404-428-6620, 404-428-6620, or through the internet at apalbert@cdc.gov. AP as in peaches, albert@cdc.gov. The telephone operator managing this meeting will leave telephone lines open throughout the entire meeting for the 15 voting ACIP members and representatives from the Centers for Medicare, Medicaid Services, as well as the presenters here in the CDC conference room. Members should mute their phones by, this is ACIP members, and should mute their phones by pressing the mute button or pressing the star 6 to toggle between mute and unmute if your phone doesn't have a mute button. All others on the call, including ACIP ex officio members, liaison representatives, and members of the general audience, will be placed in listen-only mode by the operator until Dr. Tempty calls for discussion and public comment. We ask that everyone who speaks identify herself or himself before speaking, since our voice recognition doesn't work. Dr. Tempty will take questions and comments in the following order. First will be voting ACIP members, followed by ex officio members and liaison representatives, and then general audience and members of the public, as John just outlined. When the discussion period begins, ex officio members, liaison representatives, and general audience can signal the operator if they wish to speak by pressing star 1, pressing star 1 on the telephone keypad to be placed in queue by the operator. And again, when you want to speak, it will be star 1 when the discussion period starts. To summarize conflict of interest provisions applicable to the ACIP as noted in the ACIP policies and procedure manual, members of the ACIP agree to forego participation in certain activities related to vaccines during their tenure on the committee. For certain other interests that potentially enhance the members' expertise while serving on the committee, ACIP has issued limited conflict of interest waivers. Members who conduct vaccine clinical trials or serve on data safety monitoring boards may present to the committee on matters related to those vaccines. However, they are prohibited from participating in committee votes on issues related to those vaccines. Regarding other vaccines of the affected company, a member may participate in discussion with the proviso that he or she abstain on all votes related to the vaccines of that company. It's important to note that at each meeting, ACIP members declare any conflicts of interest. At this time, the ACIP chair, Dr. Jonathan Tempty, will proceed with roll call and request disclosures of any conflicts of interest from the voting ACIP members. Dr. Tempty, it's yours.
Thank you, Dr. Pickering. Before I go to the roll call, I'm just going to mention very quickly that it is relatively unusual to have an interim meeting of ACIP like this. Just so everyone is aware that ACIP provides advice to the director of CDC on matters pertaining to use of the of FDA-licensed vaccines in the civilian population for control of vaccine-preventable diseases. And we are sometimes called in like this when there are new information available or pressing issues. But this is well within our charter. That being said, being unusual, I just need to mention very quickly the efforts of Gene Smith, Larry Pickering, Stephanie Thomas, and a slew of other people through CDC who've been working like crazy over the last 2 weeks to pull off this phone bridge. So our appreciation to our secretariat for just incredible efforts there. The other thing I'll mention very quickly is pertaining to conflict of interest and a roll call, that if when we do have votes, we really wish to reserve abstentions or abstaining from voting simply when there is a conflict of interest. With that being said, let me go through the roll call of ACIP members, and if everyone can state their name and whether or not you have any conflict of interest. And I'm just following down the list I have here. So John Tempty, and no conflict of interest. Dr. Belongia?
Edward Belongia. I receive research funding from MedImmune.
Dr. Bennett?
Nancy Bennett, no conflict.
Dr. Bocchini? Dr. Campos-Outcault?
Doug Campos-Outcault, no conflict.
Dr. Harriman?
Kathleen Harriman, no conflict.
Dr. Harrison?
Lee Harrison, no conflict.
Dr. Karen?
Ruth Karen, no conflict.
Dr. Kemp?
Allison Kemp, no conflict.
Ms. Pellegrini?
Cynthia Pellegrini, no conflicts.
Dr. Reingold?
Art Reingold, no conflicts.
Dr. Riley?
Laura Riley, no conflicts.
Dr. Romero?
Jose Romero? My institution receives funding from Pfizer and from GlaxoSmithKline for research.
Dr. Rubin?
Lori Rubin, no conflict.
And Dr. Vasquez?
Marietta Vasquez, no conflict.
Very good. We do have a quorum for this meeting. I'm also going to take roll call, though, for our ex officio members. And I'll just make a quick mention. This is the very first official meeting for Dr. Ed Belongia, Dr. Laura Riley, and Dr. Jose Romero. Formal introductions will be made at the October meeting. So if from CMS, Mary Beth Hans?
I'm on. Thank you.
And also Dr. Joseph Chin from CMS.
Yes, hello.
Department of Defense, Dr. Jesse Geib. Department of Veteran Affairs, Linda Kissinger. FDA, Dr. Wellington Sun.
This is Wellington, I'm here.
HRSA, Melissa Houston.
I'm here.
Indian Health Service, Amy Groom.
Present.
National Institutes of Health, Dr. Richard Gorman.
Present.
And National Vaccine Program Office, Dr. Bruce Gellin.
Hold on, thanks.
Thank you very much. Dr. Pickering, I believe we have a quorum.
Yes, we do. 21, and we have more than fulfilled our quorum. Thank you, John.
And with that, I will ask, I don't have the pleasure of asking Dr. Bennett to come to the podium, but Dr. Bennett, if you would be willing to start out discussion.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tempe, and thank you to all the members who are able to be here today. Our efforts today are directed towards recommendations regarding 13-valent pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. And if I could have the second slide, please. I want to first thank the members of the work group who have been working very, very hard since our June meeting. We've had a couple of extra meetings, and we've had many long and complicated discussions. So I especially want to thank the voting members, Art Reingold, Ali Kemp, and Lori Rubin, and also Jeff Duchin, who is our member who's just going off and who has joined the liaison representative. And, of course, last but certainly not least, probably foremost, is Tamara Pelishvili, who is our CDC liaison and who has been working day and night since June for us to be able to bring these recommendations to you today. If I could have the next slide, please. So this is just a reminder of the terms of reference for the pneumococcal vaccines work group. I'm not going to review these in detail. I show them every time, and I know you're all very familiar with them. If I could have the next slide, please. The focus of today's session is on routine immunization with 13-valent pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, or PCV13, for adults greater than or equal to 65 years of age, and we will be making a proposal for a vote. Next slide, please. By way of background, I wanted to remind you that PCV13 was licensed for use among adults greater than or equal to 50 years old at the very end of 2011. The FDA approved this vaccine under the accelerated approval pathway based on non-inferior immunogenicity compared to PPSV23. The indications were for prevention of pneumococcal disease, including pneumonia and invasive disease, in adults older than 50 caused by the specific serotypes that are included in PCV13. One condition of licensure was that there be a randomized controlled trial of PCV13 against pneumococcal pneumonia among adults greater than or equal to 65 years of age. This trial was completed in the Netherlands and was called CAPITA. If I could have the next slide. Just to summarize our discussions in June of 2014, we reviewed evidence, including the CAPITA results, the current knowledge that we have of the indirect herd effects of PCV13 use in children, and as well we reviewed the public health impact and cost effectiveness of various strategies for the administration of adult pneumococcal vaccines. During that meeting, we received input from the committee. There were recommendations made that we consider factors, various factors, in selecting the optimal strategy, which tomorrow we'll review, that we address the decreasing utility in using this vaccine because of the setting of increasing herd effects, and that we consider a variety of issues in the sensitivity analysis of the cost-effectiveness model that we had presented in June. The work group completed all of this work since June and eventually narrowed down to one strategy, which was that PCV13 be used in combination with PPSV23, and that's the recommendation that we're going to suggest to you today. So the objective for today's session is to consider this specific policy option and then also to hold a vote. I wanted to comment a little bit on the reasons for the accelerated timeline. This has been a matter of concern for the work group, but also I know I've talked to other members of the committee offline about their concerns. And I just wanted to review the reasons that the work group felt that an accelerated timeline was appropriate. One of the reasons was that we deferred any decision-making about recommendations in 2012 in order to hear the results of CAPITA, which is now available, and also to get the most up-to-date results on the herd effect. Another reason was that we are interested in providing the benefits of PCV13 to older adults, and we recognize that these benefits are likely to be greatest in the short term, not the long term. Since it's been almost 3 years since licensure, we felt it was important to move quickly towards making a recommendation now that we have the results of CAPITA, and we don't anticipate any additional evidence that would affect our decision in the near future. So there really wasn't any reason to extend the timeline to wait for additional data, and since we had already done that once, we felt that it was time to move forward. We also view this as an opportunity to afford the greatest population benefit of an optimal vaccination strategy against pneumococcal disease that would include PCV13 and PPSV23. And finally, it is not likely that the process of full implementation will occur until we make a recommendation. And so we felt that it was important to move forward as expeditiously as possible towards making our recommendation. Next slide, please. So the proposed language for the recommendations that we will present to you today are that adults 65 years of age or older who have not previously received pneumococcal vaccine or whose previous vaccination history is unknown should receive a dose of PCV13 first, followed by a dose of PPSV23. Next slide, please. We also are proposing language for those who have been previously vaccinated with PPSV23. That language is that adults 65 years of age or older who have not previously received PCV13 and who have previously received one or more doses of PPSV23 should receive a dose of PCV13. Just to comment briefly, and tomorrow we'll review this in much more detail, we are proposing this very simple language for the recommendations with the expectation that our recommendations about intervals will appear in the guidance that accompanies these recommendations. And tomorrow we'll review this in great detail. And then lastly, one last piece of the proposed language is that the recommendations for routine PCV13 use among adults greater than or equal to 65 years old should be reevaluated in 2018 and revised as needed. With that, I'll stop, and I'd like to turn the presentation over to Tamara Pilishvili, who will walk us through all of the considerations that the work group has reviewed since June. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bennett. Good afternoon, everyone. And first, I'd like to make sure that everyone can hear me, or am I too loud and I need to move a little bit away from the microphone?
The volume is very good, Tamara.
Great. And I also would like, in turn, to thank Dr. Bennett for her leadership of the work group and for leading us through these very complex discussions over the past year or so. Without her, we wouldn't be able to do it. So thank you, Dr. Bennett. And I will proceed with my slides and go straight to slide number 2, please. The slide 2 presents the outline that my presentation will follow. First, I will summarize the evidence that we have reviewed, all the evidence supporting the routine use of PCV13 use among adults 65 years of age or older, including the GRADE conclusion. These data have been extensively presented to the committee over the past couple of years when the vaccine was licensed and then again at the June meeting. And we also revised our GRADE review and GRADE conclusions and presented that to the committee and included this detailed evidence in the background materials that were shared before this meeting to the committee. So only the brief summary will be presented today. Next, I will proceed to reiterate again as to what the expected public health benefits of routine PCV13 use among adults 65 years or older are, and the cost effectiveness of the strategy that we are considering. I will summarize the discussions that the work group had on sequential use of PCV13 and PPSV23, evidence we reviewed, the intervals that we've narrowed down on for the recommendation language, as well as the rationale for selecting those intervals. And next, I will reiterate the issue and the question of indirect effects and the impact that the indirect effects are expected to have on the long-term utility of routine use of PCV13 among adults. And next, I will move straight to the proposed language for the recommendation and simply share the language as Dr. Bennett presented along with the guidance on the intervals. And then pause for questions and discussion. Slide 3, please. So to summarize the evidence that we have reviewed supporting PCV13 use among adults, the results of the long-awaited CAPITA trial have been presented to this committee at the June meeting. The results of this trial show that the PCV13 prevents invasive disease and non-bacteremic pneumonia among adults, a 75% efficacy against vaccine-type invasive disease has been demonstrated in this trial, and a 45% efficacy against vaccine-type non-bacteremic pneumonia. In addition, we reviewed a large body of evidence through immunogenicity studies that show that the immune response to PCV13 for the serotypes in common to PCV13 and polysaccharide vaccine was non-inferior for PCV13 compared to polysaccharide vaccine, and for some serotypes, an improved response was observed. The safety of this vaccine was demonstrated in clinical trials, and the vaccine is safe for use among adults. And we presented the great evaluation and the conclusions to this committee that demonstrate that the strong quality of evidence supports the use of this vaccine among adults 65 years of age or older. Slide 4. The recent data demonstrates that vaccine-preventable disease burden is still remaining among adults age 65 and older. In 2013, an estimated 2,600 of vaccine-type cases of invasive disease occurred, and in 1 year, an estimated 50,000 cases of vaccine-type inpatient community-acquired pneumonia occurred. In the short term, PCV13 likely provides adequate coverage of disease-causing serotypes. 20 to 25% of invasive disease is caused by PCV13 serotypes, and this is based on 2013 data, as well as an estimated 10% of all community-acquired pneumonia cases may be caused by PCV13 serotypes. And this last estimate is based on studies using serotype-specific urine antigen test, which is the same test that was applied in the CAPITA trial for their definition of non-invasive vaccine serotype pneumonia. Slide 5. The work group, as Dr. Bennett mentioned, evaluated various strategies for pneumococcal vaccination for adults. The strategies using a dose of PCV13 at age 50, 60, and 65 were considered, as well as strategies replacing using PCV13 instead of polysaccharide vaccine, as well as using PCV13 in sequence with a polysaccharide vaccine. We assessed the expected public health impact of these various strategies, as well as the cost effectiveness of these strategies. And after the June meeting, the work group was able to narrow down on one strategy and concluded that adding PCV13 at age 65 years to existing recommendations for polysaccharide vaccine would be the optimal strategy. And this is based on the expected health benefits and based on the models that we evaluated. Health benefits are expected for all outcomes assessed, as well as cost effectiveness is comparable to other adult interventions that are accepted as cost effective. This is under our base case assumptions. Slide 6. The results of the analysis assessing expected public health impact of adding PCV13 at age 65 to existing polysaccharide vaccine recommendations are presented. This is the analysis that was shared with the committee at the June meeting, and I'm presenting here the base case analysis, and I would like to reiterate, since we are not presenting the methodology again, that this is estimating the public health impact for one cohort of 65-year-olds that were followed through the lifetime, and comparing this new strategy of adding PCV13 at age 65 to existing PPSV recommendations to existing polysaccharide vaccine recommendations, which was the comparison used for all the analysis that I will share. And according to the results that we presented in June, according to these base case assumptions, health benefits are expected for all the outcomes evaluated. Over 200 cases of invasive disease are expected to be averted. Around 5,000 inpatient non-bacteriemic pneumonia cases and over 7,000 outpatient non-bacteriemic pneumonia cases, and as well as deaths associated with both invasive disease and non-bacteriemic pneumonia averted. Slide 7, cost-effectiveness analysis portion of is presented on slide 7. For the same model under base case assumptions, we estimated that costs per quali gained for this strategy are around $62,000 per quali, dollars per quali gained, and over $40,000 per life year gained. And again, as I mentioned, in terms of the cost effectiveness, this falls within the range of this, the interventions that are accepted as cost effective for other adult interventions that are accepted as cost effective. Following the June meeting, and I'm on slide 8 now, following the June meeting, we received several suggestions on the inputs for the cost effectiveness and public health impact analysis for the model that was presented at the June meeting. And for some of these inputs, we conducted sensitivity analysis and would like to show the sensitivity analysis for the select inputs that we assessed in this presentation. So, first of all, the comment was made that potentially a shorter duration of protection for PCV13 against both invasive disease and non-bacteriemic pneumonia should be considered compared to what was included in our base case analysis. In addition, the efficacy against non-bacteriemic of polysaccharide vaccine against non-bacteriemic pneumonia, we used in our base case zero efficacy against non-bacteriemic pneumonia. And I'm going to present the sensitivity analysis of changing this input. In addition, the suggestion was made to use a CMS price as a source for the vaccine cost per dose. In our base case analysis, we utilized the CDC contract price for the cost per vaccine dose, both the polysaccharide vaccine and the conjugate vaccine. Slide 9. So for the sensitivity analysis varying the inputs for waning of the PCV13 protection, the graph here with a solid blue line presents our assumption that we used for the base case. So for PCV13, we assumed a 10% annual decline in efficacy, and the red line presents the waning of immunity we assumed for the polysaccharide vaccine. So in the sensitivity analysis that I'll present, we changed this input for the conjugate vaccine. So for the first 5 years post-vaccination, we assumed no change in the efficacy, and this is based on the results shared through the CAPITA trial, which showed no measurable decline in efficacy for the duration of the trial. And then following that, we assumed a linear decline to 0% efficacy over a period of 20 years. Slide 10 presents the results of the sensitivity analysis, varying the input for waning of PCV13 protection. And the last column presents the sensitivity analysis, and the second column presents the base case analysis as presented at the June meeting. And as you can see, when we vary the input for the waning for PCV13, the number of cases averted for all the outcomes is reduced, although we didn't see a large change for all of the outcomes. And costs per quali gained are increased from $62,000 for base case to over $65,000 per quali gained, as well as the cost per life year gained. But in terms of the qualitative change in the results, we didn't observe any qualitative change in the results with the varying this input. Slide 11, an additional sensitivity analysis was performed for the input of efficacy of polysaccharide vaccine against non-bacteriemic pneumonia. So just to reiterate, for our base case analysis, we used zero efficacy against non-bacteriemic pneumonia. And the work group reviewed the available literature and published studies showing the efficacy of this vaccine against non-bacteriemic pneumonia. In particular, we focused on the meta-analysis that was conducted in 2008, which showed a 73% efficacy against non-bacterial pneumonia of PPSV. However, in this analysis, most of the studies, in fact, four out of five studies that were used for that input, for that endpoint, were conducted with the previous formulation of the polysaccharide vaccine, and only one of those five studies utilized the current formulation of the 26-valent vaccine, and that particular study showed no efficacy against non-bacteriemic pneumonia. In addition, the later meta-analysis conducted also showed by Haas and also showed no efficacy against non-bacteriemic pneumonia. There are two recent studies that reported a 64% efficacy against non-bacteriemic pneumonia, and that was a randomized controlled trial done among long-term care residents, and a later study by Ochoa Gondar that showed a 48% efficacy. That was a large cohort study conducted in Spain. And we reviewed both of these studies, and there were questions about limited generalizability of findings from the study in, among long-term care residents, as well as methodological concerns related to the proportion of disease that was bacteriemic from the cases that were used as in their main endpoint for the analysis for both studies, as well as some questions about the analytic methods. Therefore, it was decided that we would not alter our base case assumptions for this input, but we did conduct a sensitivity analysis evaluating 45% efficacy of polysaccharide vaccine against non-bacteriemic pneumonia, which is equivalent to the assumption that the input that we had for the conjugate vaccine. And the next slide presents the results of the sensitivity analysis. And as expected, we for the pneumonia and outcomes of both hospitalized and outpatient non-bacteriemic pneumonia, we see a reduction in a number of cases expected to be averted if we assume an efficacy of 45%, which is equivalent to efficacy of PCV13, and the cost per quality gained is increased to over $300,000 per quality gained. In addition, we considered using a different source for price of vaccine dose, as it was recommended. We are focusing on the population of adults 65 and older who are Medicare eligible, and we used the CMS prices instead of CDC contract prices in our sensitivity analysis, and the prices for depending on the source are listed in the table on slide 13. So in the first column are the CDC contract prices for both polysaccharide and a conjugate vaccine, and this is what we used in our base case analysis. And in the last column of the top table, the CMS prices, which represent 95% of average wholesale price. And as we understand, these are the prices that are annually reported and are being used as a maximum reimbursement price by CMS, are being set at maximum reimbursement price by CMS. So we used the inputs in the last column in our sensitivity analysis, and we also consulted our health economists in this decision to use it only for sensitivity analysis, and were advised that because the analysis was done from the societal perspective, costs were intended to reflect the value of resources used to produce intervention, whereas the CMS figure represents the reimbursements, which are not likely the resource value. And therefore, we decided to apply the CMS price in sensitivity analysis only. And the results of this sensitivity analysis are presented at the bottom part of the table on slide 13. So the changes in cost per quality are from $62,000 for our base case using CDC contract price to over $100,000 using CMS price, and also change in cost per life year saved from over $40,000 to over $72,000 per life year saved. Slide 14. So, in addition, I would like to summarize the evidence that the work group reviewed to make a determination on the use of the PCV13 and polysaccharide vaccine in sequence, and also the appropriate selection of the in the selection of the appropriate intervals for the sequential use of PCV13 and the polysaccharide vaccine. So the studies that we reviewed show that immune response is improved when conjugate vaccine is given first as the first dose before the polysaccharide vaccine. None of the studies that we evaluated and that are available have been designed to evaluate the length for an optimal interval between PCV13 and a polysaccharide vaccine. It said various intervals have been utilized in studies, 2 months interval, 6 months interval, 12 months interval, and 3 to 4 years interval. And these were individual intervals that were assessed in separate studies. And the conclusion that we drew from this evidence that there's an improved immune response compared to baseline. So there's improved immune response compared to baseline for all intervals evaluated. In other words, comparing the sequence of PCV13 followed by polysaccharide vaccine versus the baseline, there was an improved response seen for all. In addition, there was a non-inferior response post-sequence of PCV13 followed by PPSV23 versus PCV alone observed for all intervals. However, what is difficult to do is, since each of these studies used only one interval, is to make comparisons across the studies and decide what the optimal interval should be. And the work group concluded that these cross-study comparisons are really difficult to make. There was one study with direct comparisons of intervals, which looked at the 2 month interval in a series of PCV followed by polysaccharide vaccine versus a 6 month interval of PCV followed by PPSV. And the results of this study showed that the immune response was equivalent between the 2 month and 6 month interval groups. However, the study did note increased reactogenicity with a 2 month interval. Slide 15 lists some of the considerations that the work group took into consideration for selecting appropriate intervals. So, of course, we looked into immune response and safety. In addition, as we were discussing extending the interval for PCV followed by the polysaccharide vaccine, we were in our discussions mindful of the fact that the risk window for the serotypes that are included in a polysaccharide vaccine may also be increased, and therefore for that interval there will be no protection provided for these additional serotypes that are included only in the polysaccharide vaccine. In addition, we took into consideration practical aspects such as timing for the next doctor's visit, as well as programmatic considerations. And the work group conclusions on sequence and interval for the PCV13 and PPSV use are presented on slide 16. So the conclusions are that PCV13 should be given first when possible. In terms of interval between PCV13 followed by the polysaccharide vaccine, the work group felt that 6 to 12 months interval was appropriate considering all of these factors that I listed before. Interval for PCV13 when given after polysaccharide vaccine, this is for adults that have previously received the polysaccharide vaccine for either age-based or risk-based indication, interval of 1 year or longer seemed appropriate. And in addition, the work group members felt that it's important to include flexibility in the guidance if doses cannot be administered within the recommended window. In other words, a language such as if a second dose cannot be given during this time window, a dose can be given later during the next visit should be included in the guidance to providers. Slide 17, and this is the last point that I wanted to make in our discussion, and this was a topic of a lot of discussion on the work group, and it relates to indirect effects and the impact these continued indirect effects will have on long-term utility of PCV13. As we have presented several times to this committee, indirect effects of PCV7 introduction on both PCV7 serotype invasive disease as well as pneumonia, the dramatic effects have been observed among adults of all age groups. In addition, we shared with the committee data on the most recent indirect impact provided by the 3 years of the PCV13 use among children. And these PCV13 indirect effects have further reduced the proportion of adult invasive disease caused by PCV13 types as well as the pneumonia disease burden. If the impact is post-PCV13 is expected to be similar to what we saw after the 7-valent vaccine introduction, and it's similar to post-PCV7 experience, then additional reductions are likely in the next 3 to 5 years. However, given the fact that PCV13 uptake was much quicker and we did not see any slow uptake similar to what we saw with the PCV7 when the shortages were reported shortly after vaccine was licensed, then in that case, the largest impact may have already been observed because of this rapid uptake of PCV13. And nevertheless, the key point here is that the expected benefits of PCV13 use among adults will likely decline over time with the continued use of PCV13 among adults. Slide 18 reiterates and pretty much shows the evidence for what I presented on the previous slide. Is we try to estimate cases potentially preventable annually among adults 65 years or older. And I want to reiterate that the slide here does not present the cumulative impact anticipated over the time frame presented here, but rather cases potentially preventable for each year presented. So we estimated that in 2015, if we assume a 20% reduction, additional reduction due to herd effects, and this is again looking at the same time frame post-PCV7 introduction, and assuming that the coverage will be maybe the first year would not be as high, maybe 10%, but we ranged it from 5 to 30%, then the estimated cases potentially preventable are 160 for invasive disease, over 2,000 cases of inpatient community-acquired pneumonia, and almost 3,000 cases of outpatient community-acquired pneumonia are expected to be prevented in the first year. And this is assuming very conservative estimates for coverage. Now, if we fast forward it to 2019, based on the post-PCV7 experience, 86% reductions in due to herd effects occurred between the years of 2003 and 2009. So therefore, from 2013 to 2019, if we expect the same type of impact and 86% additional reduction in due to herd effects, and also take into account that the coverage may improve. So even with a tripling of the coverage, as you can see, the number of cases potentially preventable is lower in 2019, and this is because of the assumed and expected herd effects. Slide 19, I would like to summarize the work group conclusions. In the short term, a recommendation for universal PCV13 use is warranted. In the long term, continued herd effects may limit the utility of a universal recommendation. We don't know what the magnitude of these indirect effects will be, and there's also uncertainty around the burden of vaccine-preventable non-bacteriemic pneumonia, because we're making assumptions based on these recently introduced serotype-specific urine antigen tests in all our estimation of observed and expected disease burden, non-bacteriemic pneumonia disease burden. Nevertheless, there is opportunity to prevent disease during the upcoming respiratory season. Slide 20, I will proceed to present the workgroup proposal for the language for pneumococcal vaccine use among adults. Slide 21. Highlights the different groups of categories of adults that we are considering with this proposed recommendation. So first of all, we already have the recommendation in place for adults with immunocompromising conditions. For this discussion and going forward for the proposed recommendation language, we are not including adults who previously received PCV13 for one of the indications based on the 2012 ACIP recommendations. So the discussions and the language that I'm going to share with you focuses on adults who have not received PCV13 previously. And then within this group, we have adults who are naive to polysaccharide vaccine, as well as those that would have received a dose or more of the polysaccharide vaccine for their age-based or risk-based indication. So both of these groups are being considered for this recommendation. Slide 22, we proposed that adults greater than, this is a proposal, proposed language for adults 65 years of age or older with no previous pneumococcal vaccine history, PCV13 or PPSV23. So we proposed the following language. Adults 65 years of age or older who have not previously received pneumococcal vaccine or whose previous vaccination history is unknown should receive a dose of PCV13 first, followed by a dose of PPSV23. Slide 23 includes guidance on intervals for sequential use for adults with no previous pneumococcal vaccine history. A dose of PPSV23 should be given 6 to 12 months following a dose of PCV13. If PPSV23 cannot be given during this time window, a dose of PPSV should be given during the next visit. And then the clarification that the two vaccines should not be co-administered. And a diagram at the bottom of slide 23 presents it graphically of what the recommendations would look like for pneumococcal vaccine-naive adults. Slide 24. Presents the language for PCV13 naive adults 65 years of age or older previously vaccinated with a polysaccharide vaccine. We propose that adults 65 years of age or older who have not previously received PCV13 and who have previously received one or more doses of PPSV23 should receive a dose of PCV13. Slide 25 presents the proposed guidance on intervals for sequential use for adults previously vaccinated with polysaccharide vaccine. A dose of PCV13 should be given at least 1 year after the receipt of the most recent PPSV dose. For those for whom an additional dose of PPSV is indicated, such dose should be given 6 to 12 months after PCV13 and at least 5 years since the most recent dose of PPSV23. And the diagrams at the bottom of slide 25 present how the recommendations would look for individuals that received PPSV at age 65 or later, or who received a dose of PPSV before age 65 for one of the indications, current indications for polysaccharide vaccines. And on slide 26, the proposed language to address potential time-limited utility of routine PCV13 use among adults 65 years or older is presented. The recommendations for routine PCV13 use among adults greater than 60 or equal to 65 years old should be reevaluated in 2018 and revised as needed. Slide 27 summarizes the work group conclusions to address the potential time-limited utility of routine PCV13 use among adults. The work group felt that it's important to continue monitoring vaccine uptake of PCV13 and PPSV23, as well as to continue monitoring the trends in disease burden, vaccine-type disease burden, both invasive disease and pneumonia, in order to evaluate the impact of new recommendations in a target population of adults, a vaccine target population of adults 65 years of age or older. In addition, the continued monitoring of disease trends among PCV13-naive adults, and again, both invasive disease and non-invasive disease caused by vaccine serotypes is needed to evaluate the impact of continued herd effects and the long-term utility of routine PCV13 use among adults. Slide 28. ACIP should be routinely updated on the changes in vaccine-preventable disease burden among adults due to PCV13 direct and indirect effects during the next 3 years. And these data should inform revisions as needed to the proposed adult PCV13 recommendations in 2018. Decline in burden of PCV13-type disease among adults younger than 65 years due to indirect effect of vaccinating children may signal that PCV13 is no longer needed. And revised cost-effectiveness evaluation incorporating changes in disease burden, vaccine uptake, and the cost of the vaccine will help align this recommendation with other adult vaccines in use. So I would like to pause here and turn it over to Dr. Tamti for questions and discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to just make sure I'm back online. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay, good. Just making sure the muting function is working. Let's, I think at this point.
John, this is Larry Pickering. Before you start, there have been three people that have been on the line but were muted when asked if they were on the line. One of them is a member, and that's Joe Bocchini. So if you can get his conflicts from him, Linda Kessinger and Jesse Geiber also now on the line.
Okay, so Dr. Bocchini, any conflicts of interest?
No, Joseph Bocchini, no conflicts. I apparently was on the wrong phone line and didn't have access to voice.
Well, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
And then we do have representation from CMS and from Department of Veterans Affairs and Department of Defense. So thanks for joining. Okay, with that, are there questions or comments from ACIP members? And again, I think we just need to provide our last name and hopefully we can monitor and moderate the discussion well.
Hey, this is Lee Harrison.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so one of the issues that was discussed at the meeting was whether both vaccines would be covered. And I gather from some of the background materials that there won't be coverage until 2016. So I was wondering how this might impact the implementation of the program in the short run.
Does the want to respond to that, or
could we ask our CMS liaisons to respond to this question, please?
Dr. Chin, would you like to comment?
Oh, sure. This is Joe Chin, the Coverage Analysis Group, CMS. I think basically there's two situations where it would be potential influence from Medicare standpoint. I think for the ones that you recommend the shot that haven't received a vaccine under Medicare, For those individuals, that probably have less of an impact in the immediate, you know, short term. Mostly it's for those individuals that have received a prior vaccination, likely to be the 23-valent one, and adding the second one. So currently our coverage, you know, policy is that there's one specific, there's one actual vaccination for all adults under Medicare. And I think there's two slides that I have, and if you can pull those up, I can, you know, that can some background. I can just basically describe that situation. There are some rare instances where some individuals at the highest risk, and that's specifically defined in our regulation, may receive a second vaccine under Medicare, but that's not in general practice. So in the immediate, you know, time frame, it would be unlikely for those that actually have received a prior vaccine to receive it again, you know, mainly in this situation for this coming season. For us to actually make modifications in the coverage policy, I think we would look at any change in recommendations from your committee, the new recommendations, and look at the supporting evidence, you know, for the change. If CMS decides to, you know, proceed with a change in coverage to allow, you know, for example, a two-shot regimen, there is a couple of, you know, policy mechanisms to actually do so. I don't know which one would actually be most appropriate for this type of change. We would need to really discuss with our general counsel. I guess I'm saying from, you know, some really past experience, when there is a substantial change in recommendation or in the coverage policy, our typical, you know, approach has to use a mechanism that allow some public comment into that, you know, change, which typically is, in this situation, a rule or regulation, basically through rulemaking. And that does take, there is a process for that, and it does take some time. Typically, we enter rulemaking at the beginning of the year with a proposed rule, usually in the summer, and a final rule in November, being effective the following January. So, in that sense, if CMS were to, you know, undergo a change, it likely would be a year before a second dose would be available for those that have been, you know, previously vaccinated. I think if the recommendation came out in the fall, it's probably the best time frame, you know, for us to be in. You know, we wouldn't have to overlap so that we could start in the next cycle, which would be about a year for those, a year and a half for those individuals that would want a second shot. And that would be the consideration there. So I think depending on the recommendation from the committee, there is, you know, a mechanism and an opportunity for CMS to modify the coverage policy for that. We would like to, you know, obviously see the recommendation and the supporting evidence for it to make that determination.
Like, I'm trying to envision the program. So somebody turns 65, they get the first vaccine, and then they're turned down for the second vaccine. I'm just wondering, you know, what the implication is for this recommendation.
So I think if they wanted to get a second vaccine this year, there is no, you know, mechanism to allow that right now. You know, right. So I think, I mean, if there was a change in your recommendation, ACIP's recommendation, we could, you know, really look into that and say that we will address it in our next, if we, you know, if there is evidence to support that, to address it in our next cycle. And there will also be some people that won't be able to get it immediately, but I think by, you know, just, you know, communicating that we are looking at it, I think they could possibly get it if we do make changes in the following year. So in that sense, I think we would be open to modifying that.
Dr. Chin, Dr. Tempty here for just a little more clarification. With the a second pneumococcal vaccine for a Medicare recipient, the cost of the vaccine would be denied for coverage and the administration fee. Is that correct?
Right now, if an individual has had a vaccine under Medicare, Medicare Part B, a second one wouldn't be typically covered unless they're in the highest risk group. So that is basically administration and the vaccine itself.
Thank you.
John, I got a question.
Dr. Campos-Alcor.
On that same vein, is there any chance this vaccine could be made a Part D like dog vaccine rather than Part B like boy?
Right. Many vaccines that aren't covered under B are maybe covered under D. However, since we have a very specific statute that covers pneumococcal vaccine as Part B, that's where the benefit is. So it's a Part B benefit right now. And it's unlikely to cross two programs. Thanks.
John, I have a question. This is Kemp.
Yeah, Dr. Kemp.
It's a follow-up to the same issue. I'm not concerned that somebody would be denied for a year, but I am concerned about the risk window for the PPSV23-only serotypes, perhaps changing our calculus if this is a prolonged process. So what is the chance that this wouldn't happen for 3 years or not at all?
I think that's a good question. It really would be based on the evidence and your recommendation. And from my initial review, it's evidence being supported by a randomized trial is obviously very strong. So in that sense, obviously we would like to see a publication from that, but aside from that, being supported by a randomized trial is obviously helpful. A change of recommendation would also be helpful. In that sense, if there is really shown benefit for the Medicare population, and that's really what I think drives our decisions, and if it's clearly demonstrated, that really would be, a major factor in us wanting to make changes in the policy to actually improve the health of the population. I think that's really where we would look at. And from the preliminary read, I think this actually does meet those specific criteria. So answering, I think it would be then unlikely that we wouldn't make any change. Based on the evidence. How long it would take, I think what I described would be the optimal time frame if we can all get the really documents and clearances in place. And I think that's the typical time frame also if for some things that we have proposed in the past. So if we were to do something, I think it would be more likely that we could do it in the typical 12-month time frame. That's probably as best I can say without really looking at that specific languages.
Dr. Tempty, a question?
Go ahead.
Sorry, this is Cindy Pellegrini. So I think this is an incredibly important question, not because it should affect the actual science of the recommendation, but because it is going to have such tremendous bearing on the implementation from a practical perspective, whether this is going to be taken up, whether people are going to be able to afford to have this vaccine or not. And I admit I'm really troubled that here we are as a group feeling a great deal of urgency, having an interim meeting, and it doesn't seem that CMS shares that urgency, that there's going to be, a minimum of a year here lag if we make a recommendation today. So I realize this is very challenging because this particular vaccine is in the statute, so it's kind of under a different standard than some of the others. but I'd like to ask our CMS representative whether the agency might possibly consider issuing an interim final rule in January or February or March, which would allow the recommendation to go into effect and coverage to begin, but still allow for public comment and later refinement of the rule.
That's a good question, a good suggestion also. I'm not able to respond to that. I would certainly make note of it and discuss it with basically our director to really see, you know, how feasible doing an interim final would be.
This is Art Reingold. Could I ask a question about that? I don't quite understand the financial aspect of it, so... is this the kind of thing where if you make a determination that this can go ahead, does this need congressional approval for the extra expenditures? Several hundred million dollars? Or is that basically something that happens because you guys determine it?
But typically with, you know, coverage decisions, the costs for most services are not directly, you know, calculated in a manner such as you mentioned. So... there are a few rare instances where, you know, cost is entered into the equation, when we're actually, and not specifically for indemnizations. And those services are basically always, you know, described in statute, and this is not one of them.
I think just some informational follow-up, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think currently there are about 44 million Americans age 65 and older. I believe that roughly 65% of those individuals have already received PPSV 23. And I believe there's also about 2 million Americans entering Medicare per year, or approximately 170 to 180,000 per month. Are those roughly correct?
I think they are. The Medicare population also covers the disabled, so that adds about 8 million. So the total amount is roughly, you know, 50 million, which, you know, 44% are of the older adults. And our typical enrollment is usually 1.5 to 2 million, but as you all know, the baby boomers are really starting to age into the population, and at the peak of those, if you look at the demographics, it's up to 4 million, you know, individuals at one each year. So eventually I would get to a point. But, right, I think the numbers you had are actually good estimates.
Other questions?
John, it's Doug again.
Dr. Kepozolko.
Yeah, staying on this same issue, I have two further questions. The first is to clarify that this recommendation, if we make it sometime this fall, is likely not to be implemented until January 2016. Is that correct?
With our typical, you know, I think mechanism to make changes in for these type of coverages in statute, that would be the typical time frame. As mentioned, there are some other vehicles for, you know, making changes that may happen a little quicker, although they're rare, and that really would require, I mean, I can't, you know, commit to anything, you know, such as those at this point.
Okay, all right. But I just want to make sure that people are talking a year from now, and that's really not the case. It's really about 16 months from now or 15 months from now.
Right. So... I think there was one estimate if we actually, you know, proceeded, you know, rapidly implementing, you know, drafting the rule and regulation, that it would be effective January 2016.
Okay, thanks. The second point was, and the reason I asked it about the possibility of it ending up in Part D rather than B. I'm not familiar with the statute on pneumococcal vaccine, whether it's specific to a particular vaccine or if it's general to a disease or a bacteria. But in the past, some vaccines have been put into Part D rather than Part B because of consideration of this formula that calculates this payment, the reduction to physicians when costs go over a certain amount. Not that it's ever been implemented, and it's there's an attempt to fix it, but in the past, cost of vaccines have been a consideration in there, and then that doesn't count when they go into Part D. Is that correct?
I'm not very familiar with the way Part D, you know, prices or decides actually, you know, what to include, and they do have a mechanism they go through with their benefit policies. I think I know that the statute for pneumococcal vaccine is in Part B, and it's not specific. It basically is for a pneumococcal vaccination, so it doesn't specify any particular formulation. So
that would probably keep it in Part B, boy.
Right. So when it's usually in one of the sort of programs, it usually stays in the same program.
Okay. Dr. Shuket.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment to make sure that those listening are on the same page. Usually when ACIP makes a recommendation, there is a lag before insurance coverage picks that up, whether it's public or private insurance. It turns out, though, for the pneumococcal conjugate 13-valent vaccine for Medicare beneficiaries, it would immediately be covered under Part B for those who have not had a previous vaccine or have unknown prior vaccine status. So unlike usual recommendations that don't go out, that aren't required by insurance by private insurance until the calendar year following the publication in the MMWR, Medicare Part B uptake of a first dose of the 13-valent conjugate vaccine could be taken up immediately. The issue that is unclear in timing is how long it would take Medicare for their process, which will, as Dr. Chin described, could take a few different paths, to implement a second dose, whether it's a conjugate following a polysaccharide or a polysaccharide following a conjugate. And the proposal that the working group queued up was an interval that could be 6 to 12 months in terms of the guidance with some flexibility. So just to make sure that people understand, the vote that you'd be taking with some sense of urgency about what can happen this fall, a first dose of conjugate vaccine for unvaccinated people or those with unknown status would have no delay in Medicare Part B uptake because of how the statute is written. The Medicare authorities, following an ACIP vote, will review the evidence and look at their process and sort out how quickly or slowly the sequential subsequent dose language could catch up with ACIP, but there's no delay for that first dose, which is why the group was being convened for a vote now, given the 5,000, community acquired pneumonias that might be prevented if there's 10% uptake of a vaccine this year. So that's sort of just clarifying that no delay, which is really unusual for an ACIP vote, but a delay for the second subsequent dose in terms of Medicare Part B coverage catching up with it.
And if I can follow that up, Dr. Shuket, if you just do some of the back of the envelope calculations, that basically applies to 15 million elder Americans who are over the age of 65 receiving Medicare benefits and have not received a pneumococcal vaccination as of yet. Unfortunately, many of those are people who either refuse or are in situations where the vaccine has not been offered or have problems with access to care, but still there's a large group of individuals out there that this could apply to basically immediately. And also, I think with new enrollees, the last figure that I saw was about 170,000 baby boomers entering retirement per month right now, or entering age 65 per month.
This is Kathy Harriman. I have a question.
Go ahead.
So with regards to this issue of CMS, when we talk about people with unknown history being eligible now and being recommended to go ahead and receive vaccine, CMS must know in their records if that person has received vaccine before, or maybe they don't. I don't know what kind of system they have, but in theory, they could then reject payment for that vaccine for somebody with the unknown history. Or am I understanding that correctly? And then I just had another question about a different issue.
I think sometimes it's less straightforward than that in terms of being able to go back to track the vaccines in prior years. So in that sense, and actually in real time, so it's difficult to say, I think, you know, how many would be rejected, if any at all, in that situation.
And maybe that's the reality for anyone who's getting a second dose then. It's possible it may or may not be rejected. Is that correct?
The recommendation that the way it's written is based on a clinical recommendation. So I don't know the actual, if you're asking about the actual system coding edits, I'm not exactly sure what's in place at this point.
And then I just had a second question on a different issue, and this is slide 13. And this is just for my own knowledge, because I didn't quite understand the rationale for not using the CMS price for the vaccine in the analysis. It's bullet 3. There's a reason, but I didn't quite understand it. And that would be for Tamara.
Yes, we'll bring up slide 13. And meanwhile, if I can ask Dr. Stecker, who should be online, because he's one of the health economists we consulted who advised us how the analysis should be done. If Dr. Stecker can comment, please.
Hi, yeah, this is Charles Stecker. I'm with Tulane University. So we didn't want to necessarily use the CMS prices or CMS reimbursement rates as the price, because these are reimbursements and don't necessarily reflect the resources expended to produce the vaccine. Some of this is possibly a transfer payment to other parties. And when we're taking the societal perspective, we just want to talk about the production cost of this vaccine.
Is that what we do for when we cost other vaccines for, in similar analyses? Do we use that kind of rationale or use those costs?
Yeah, in general, we don't want to use transfer payments. Those are payments just made from one party to another that don't necessarily reflect a creation of value.
Thank you.
I'm going to make a quick mention. If there are ex officio or liaison members who have questions, just ask the operator to open up the line to start registering those questions. And I have somebody else here for a question.
John, this is Art. I have a question and a comment.
Yeah, Dr. Engold.
So my question is, I thought, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I thought for the polysaccharide, the recommendation was that people get a second dose 5 years after the first dose, or at least some individuals would get a second dose. And I don't know if that's covered under Part B and whether that's relevant or not, but it seems to me at this point, even now, doesn't CMS cover some second doses of pneumococcal vaccine? That's my question. And then my comment on a slightly different issue, and this is something I've surfaced in the working group before, it relates to slide 27, which has to do with monitoring the impact of introducing the conjugate vaccine into the over 65 population. I'm certainly all in favor of what's laid out on slide 27. I'm not smart enough to understand how we'll actually disentangle the data about the indirect effects of vaccinating children versus the direct effects of vaccinating the elderly.
Yep.
So I just want to be cautious in giving the implying with this slide that at some point in the future we're going to be able to disentangle that unless somebody can explain to me how we're going to.
Yes.
Hi, it's Ruth Karen. I have two questions, one of which is a little bit related to arts, unless somebody wants to comment on his last comment.
I can comment on the first part, I guess, Joe Chin for CMS. Basically, the revaccination is for, in the way Medicare defines it, for this group of highest risk is basically immunocompromised, and those can get a second vaccination after 5 years, but that's a small group.
Shall I go ahead, John?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Does someone from the CDC want to comment on our second comment? Because I think we have thought about this a little bit.
So, I can attempt to comment, Nana. This is Tamara. So we've discussed on a work group, and I think everyone agreed that it will be challenging to disentangle, and I think what we present here on slide 27 is just a general approach, is that we will have age-based recommendations. The recommendations will focus on adults 65 and older, and we will have we will not have routine use of PCV13 among younger adults. So monitoring the disease in among younger adults will give us some indication of what the contribution of herd effects is. Again, I agree this will not be a clean clear-cut understanding of what's the contribution of direct versus indirect effects, but I think this is still up for discussion, and I don't think we meant this slide to be like a final proposal for a defined study that would allow us to disentangle herd effects from indirect effects. And I agree with Dr. Reingold's comment that it will be challenging to disentangle those two effects.
Yeah, I just, if I could comment for a moment, I agree. I think it will be very complicated, but I do think that we have the potential, particularly in the EIP sites, to look at the rates of disease in vaccinated people versus the rates of disease in unvaccinated people. It won't be easy, but there is, if we are able to collect vaccination rates and good data on the cases that occur, both and both IPD and non-bacteremic pneumonia, we may be able to make some inferences from putting those data together.
But isn't the issue the indirect effects of vaccinating adults with PCV13 and figuring out contribution of that versus indirect effects of kids getting PCV13? I mean, maybe differences in vaccine coverage which are going to be great, I think, very large in the first couple of years, that may help. But that's the issue I thought Art was getting at.
It is, Lee. Thank you.
Sorry, I don't think there's a good answer for that.
We can talk about that over a beer.
Right.
Or two.
I thought you were referring to the indirect effects in children. But
I think it's going to be hard. Let me put it that way.
Okay. Dr. Karen.
Yes. So two questions, one really in follow-up to Art's question, and I recognize all the difficulties that he raises, but my first question is about the timeline for reassessment and the choice of 2018 as a time to do that. I just as a comment, this is the most expensive vaccine that we have in our armamentarium, and we want to use it as long as we need to use it to provide protection, but we probably don't want to use it beyond that time period. So my first question is really about whether we should do some assessments, recognizing that they're difficult earlier than that. And then my second question actually has to do with the interval between PCV and PPSV. I understand that we're not being asked to vote on recommendations related to that interval, that's really going to be in the guidance. But it seemed from the data that were presented that there isn't a lot of data on exactly what that interval should be. And given some of the programmatic considerations, I was wondering whether there might be some thought given to specifying a minimum interval and then allowing beyond that, so not less than 2 months or whatever that might be, rather than a particularly 6 to 12.
Right. This is Tamara. So I'll start with the first question related to 2018. So I think the 2018 was something that the work group projected based on expected herd effects post-PCV7 and when we would have expected to see maximum herd effects observed, and potentially that's a good timing to reevaluate the recommendation. But I will agree with Dr. Karen's comment that, especially for some of the studies that that could monitor the trends over the period of time, this is not a one-time assessment, and this can be done on a continuous basis. And in fact, I think in one of the slides, we do propose that the ACIP will be continuously be updated on the, both the direct and indirect impact of the new recommendations. So yes, I mean the 2018 was based on projections, but we do not propose that we do nothing in between. Related to the second question, as I mentioned, the evidence we didn't have the perfect evidence to allow us to say this interval, one interval, is better than the other, and therefore the practical considerations is what swayed us towards that 6 to 12 month interval, and based on the. So the comments that we received from the providers on our work group that felt that the practical time where you would see a patient come back for the second visit will be within that window of 6 to 12 months, but at the same time, everyone's on the work group felt that it is important to allow the flexibility so that the providers do not interpret this 6 to 12 in 12 month interval as the only possibility for giving a subsequent dose, and that it can be, there is a flexibility allowed. Related to your comment on having the minimum interval, that was actually something that we, the way we started approaching the guidance, which is similar to what we have for immunocompromised adults, and wording it as 8 weeks or greater. However, the concerns that we heard on the work group is that this does not really provide a good guidance to providers on when it's actually better or when it's good and when it's okay. So they actually want a more defined interval rather than 8 weeks or longer, which is a very it can be eight weeks or 1 year. It's a big difference. And also from the programmatic standpoint for immunization services and for quality measures, the work group members felt that providing some more defined interval as in the primary language would be useful for providers.
John, this is Ed Belanger. I'd like to make a comment, if I could.
Yes, Dr. Belanger.
Thank you. Well, first, let me just say that I'm new to ACIP, and I wish I was had the opportunity to be there with everybody in person rather than a voice on the phone. I'm a little hesitant to speak up, I guess, at this point because I am new, and I don't have all the history that all the members have, and I'm very much aware of that. And I really appreciate all the hard work by the work group and the CEC staff to perform all these analyses that we've been talking about. And I've gone back and I've looked at the video of the June meeting. I've gone over all the slides and I've read a lot of the original references that sort of were referenced in the presentations. And I just had a couple issues I wanted to bring up for consideration, more related to the science rather than sort of the implementation of it. And I guess sort of my concern, and I invite anyone to sort of respond to this, is that this analysis seems to me kind of rushed, and I'm concerned that it may not be yet sufficiently robust to support a change in national policy. And I think the work group did a tremendous job given the time frame they had to produce this by, but I think sort of the complexity of what we're dealing with is such that it's practically impossible to sort of fully understand all the implications of this in less than 2 months. So there are three issues in particular that sort of concern me about the analysis, and I'm talking about the impact on burden of illness and cost analysis, not the CAPITA study itself. One is that the entire analysis essentially hinges on the assumption that 10% of all community-acquired pneumonia is due to vaccine-type pneumococcal disease, and that's based on four studies, three of which are unpublished, and all of which use the proprietary Pfizer diagnostic urine test to identify vaccine-type cases of pneumococcal disease. Then the second thing that is a little concerning to me is the fact that the results from those studies, which are using highly validated cases of radiographically confirmed pneumonia, are extrapolated to incidence rates that are based merely on ICD codes, which I'm positive have a substantially lower predictive value compared to using a research-based case definition for pneumonia. And then lastly, sort of the assumption in the base case of vaccine efficacy of PPSV23 against pneumococcal pneumonia of zero. And I know the sensitivity analysis was done using 45%, and I think that's great. But in that analysis, everything else was sort of held at the base level, and so that was the only thing that was manipulated, if I understand that correctly. And I think, you know, we learned some lessons from the flu vaccine, which I'm a lot more familiar with than this vaccine, in terms of the dangers of relying on nonspecific outcomes to sort of estimate the impact of an intervention. And it seems like that's sort of largely what this analysis is doing. So it could be in the end that this policy is exactly the right thing to do. I just, at this moment, I feel rather uncomfortable that I have enough evidence to make that judgment.
Can I comment on that?
Please, yes.
So this is Nana Bennett. As you and I have discussed previously, I think there are a lot of questions about moving forward with this. But I also feel that the data and the weaknesses that you point to in the data are not issues that we are likely to be able to resolve in a timely manner. I think these are really profound issues with respect to our knowledge of pneumonia. And this has been sort of the bugaboo of pneumococcal vaccine for the last, 25, 30 years. And I totally agree with you that these data are not perfect at all and that the analysis is not perfect as a result. But I guess I feel when I see them in the context of the last 25 or 30 years, I feel as though we're moving towards better knowledge and that we're not going to be there tomorrow. And I think the work group concluded that this problem really wasn't going to get resolved in a timely manner and that the longer we waited, the less we afforded those over the age of 65 in our country the protection from this vaccine. And we just didn't really see a moment in the future where all of these questions would be answered in a way that was satisfying, and so we really felt there was no more forthcoming information that would help us.
Yeah, and I certainly appreciate that. And again, not having sort of the history that all of you have, you know, looking at some of the references, like you know, the used Lonnie Simonson study to look at sort of all cause pneumonia and then estimate the proportion of vaccine types. But she also reported data for hospitalized non-invasive pneumococcal or lobar pneumonia, which should be a much more specific kind of outcome, much more likely to be pneumococcus than taking all-cause pneumonia. And similarly, in the outpatient setting, you know, it's a wild guess as to what proportion of ICD-coded pneumonia actually represents pneumococcal pneumonia. And so, you know, I think it would be possible to do some additional analyses that sort of look at some more some endpoints like IPD and hospitalized pneumococcal or lobar pneumonia to see, and then use some sensitivity analyses, assuming some different proportions that are vaccine type, to just see if these findings are robust and if this is the best intervention, you know, compared to all the other possible interventions that the work group considered under a range of scenarios. That's all. Thanks.
I'd like to follow up Dr. Belanger's question with one additional, just in terms of the evidence out there, and I believe this is on slide number 3, Dr. Pilashvili, and it's the from the CAPITA trial showing a 45% efficacy of PCV13 in prevention of non-bacteremic pneumonia. The study was done in the Netherlands, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe that they use a PPSV23 or equivalent in elderly, and the patients recruited for the study were all pneumococcal vaccine naive. And so I think that maximizes the benefit. But was that something that was looked at or considered either in deliberations of the working group or in the cost-effectiveness?
Right, Dr. Dempsey, I guess as you pointed out, it's, that's correct. PPSV is not routinely recommended in the Netherlands and is not being used, and this was a placebo-controlled trial, and this was a trial among adults that were naive to the polysaccharide vaccine. The way we accounted for it is when we conducted the grade review of evidence. So when we the comparison for the grade we were interested in was comparing PCV to the current standard of care of polysaccharide vaccine, whereas the trial results were comparing it to the placebo, and therefore we downgraded the evidence, but overall conclusion was that there's a still strong type 2 quality evidence, and the reason it was type 2 is because we downgraded because of not having the correct comparison group when extrapolating capita results.
Okay, thank you. The other question I have is, to what extent in this country are doses of pneumococcal vaccine in patients 65 and older coupled with influenza? I know that a lot of clinics, mine included, will have standing orders for both pneumococcal and influenza vaccine during the season that we typically immunize for influenza. And I suspect that a lot of people receive their pneumococcal vaccine in conjunction, but I don't have any idea how prevalent that is. Do you have any information on that?
You know, John, we don't, this is Ann Shuka responding, we don't have that number at our fingertips. We could get it in the future, but one thing to remind people was that in the CAPITA study, many of the individuals received, in the placebo and pneumococcal conjugate arm, received influenza vaccine with their investigational vaccine. Quite a bit of adult immunization occurs in conjunction with influenza vaccination, so it's not unlikely that a lot of the polysaccharide doses that are given essentially once only to people 65 and over would be at the time they're also getting their annual flu vaccine.
It's just a vehicle, I think, in primary care that we use all the time in terms of implementing vaccine policy, the standing orders, and you call your clinic and come in for immunization. It tends to work very well, and it's one of the things in the community services task force evidence-based portfolio in terms of things that actually do work.
And John, if I may, this is Nana. One of the reasons that we are eager to move forward with this recommendation is that we would hope that as that happens this year, that it would be PCV as the first dose with their flu vaccine.
John, this is Doug. I have a couple questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
A couple of them have to do with topics we just covered. The first one has to do with slide 3. And the fourth bullet, because I think this is worded incorrectly. This is kind of a minor point, and I don't think it's going to affect the discussion very much. But type 2 evidence or level 2 evidence is moderate, not strong. And I'm not sure where that term strong came from. That's not something that's in our methodology. Am I wrong about that?
I think you're correct there, Doug.
So we have high, moderate, low, and very low. So level 2 is moderate. So I think that's slide needs to be corrected. the second one has to do with the co-administration of vaccines. What do we know about this vaccine and co-administration in this age group regarding adverse reactions as well as the benefit of this vaccine and the other that might be co-administered? So I'm talking about potentially Zostavax, Tdap, and influenza. Normally in child vaccines, this is one of the things that's tested. is the effect on other vaccines and on the vaccine in question, co-administration. Was this studied at all with this vaccine?
Well, just one quick comment. Yes, in CAPITA, many of the people who participated in CAPITA got both vaccines.
But that's entirely different than actually studying the
right.
question.
Right. I don't believe that the efficacy of the flu vaccine was studied at the same time.
Okay, so we really don't know the effect of co-administration of flu vaccine and pneumococcal on either. And what about Tdap and Zostavax?
You know, I believe the company did describe some of that in the previous presentations, but I would just remind people, in 65 and up, the Tdap recommendation is based on fairly indirect information, and the recommendation for the consideration for the 13-valent vaccine is now being considered based on a randomized placebo-controlled trial in 85,000 people, much of the vaccine being co-administered with influenza. So I think it's likely to mimic the performance of the vaccine when given with influenza. But we could check with the company about the data that they have developed, if there is data, about immunogenicity results for PCV13 given at the same time as other adult vaccines. I'm also not personally familiar with the literature on PPSV23 co-administered with other vaccines. So that those are gaps we could try to look into. But again, the CAPITA results would be mimicking that influenza and flu and PCV13 co-administration with clinical protection data.
So let me just continue to follow up on that, because it seems like we ought to be providing some guidance on that question. If co-administration is okay or not, I mean, it really kind of stands out that we're not saying anything about that. But we do for most other vaccines.
This is Tamara, and I think we can definitely review in more detail all the available data and include it in a guidance when it comes to the language on co-administration of this vaccine with other recommended vaccines. But I just wanted to remind that initially when the immunogenicity data was presented to this committee, the data on co-administration with the flu vaccine was shared. And I think the bottom line conclusions were that non-inferiority was demonstrated applying the statistical tests PCV was co-administered with a flu vaccine versus separately, but there was a lower response observed for some serotypes. However, I'd like to caution that the reason we did not recommend this vaccine based on immunogenicity data initially before the CAPITA trial results were available is because we didn't quite understand the correlate of protection among adults. So in other words, those lower antibody response that was seen for some serotypes with co-administration with the flu vaccine, we have a way of translating that into clinical protection.
This is Ed Belanger. Can I make another comment, John?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So I wondered if, you know, anyone had considered on the work group or at CDC the potential to sort of, given the sort of perceived urgency of this and the fact that the CAPITA findings are very important, to sort of issue an interim guidance that PCV13 may be used in lieu of PPSV in people over 65, and that ACIP will be issuing sort of more comprehensive recommendations in 2015 regarding the use of those two vaccines, which buys some more time to sort of carefully look at this.
We did talk briefly about an interim recommendation, but again, we were not confident that we would have a pathway to a more firm recommendation than we already have. And also there was a concern about implementation. As we've discussed today, Medicare moving forward with coverage for two pneumococcal vaccines really depends on our making a recommendation. And so we felt that it was worthwhile to go forward.
John, I got one more.
Dr. Campos-Oakle.
Yeah. So this question has to do with spacing between. I've seen that the information spacing of PPSV23 after PCV13. I'd like to discuss the opposite, which is PCV13 after PPSV23. What do we know about that interval? What is the optimal interval, and what is it based on? Because keep in mind, two-thirds of the people over 65 have had PPSV23 and now are getting a recommendation to get a PCV13, and although they probably won't get it for a year to a year and a half, but I just wonder how solid is this interval data, and what are we basing it on, that 6 to 12 months?
So this is Tamara again. As is with the previous interval of PCV followed by PPSV, there is no data available that no studies that have looked at what the optimal waiting interval should be post in adults that have received previously polysaccharide vaccine and when is the optimal interval to give the conjugate vaccine. And we were basing it on all studies that are available and out there, the intervals that have been evaluated in various studies. And also I would like to remind the committee that this evidence has been reviewed previously, and a similar recommendation was made for immunocompromised adults where we said that waiting for 1 year or longer was optimal for following the polysaccharide vaccine before giving the conjugate vaccine. And again, the data are also limited even for that interval because no studies have looked at what is the optimal interval and is the response improved whether we wait longer or more.
Okay, so if we go to slide 23 then, we say a dose of, this is the optimal sequence here, so it's a separate question. But you say 6 to 12 months following a dose of PCV13. Is less than 6 months acceptable, or are we going to say, because you say you want to have some flexibility, do we have a minimum time or that we would say has to pass?
So minimum time, as I mentioned earlier, it was something that we had incorporated in the initial language, and the work group didn't like that open-ended 8 weeks or later, but we could certainly, if that provides additional guidance to providers, include that minimum interval the same way that we included an open-ended maximum interval in the guidance language. But intervals as short as 8 weeks have been evaluated with an adequate immune response, and the only study that I shared that looked at 2 months versus 6 months interval showed that with a 2 months or 8 weeks interval, they had a little more reactogenicity observed than compared to the 6 months interval.
Okay, so a little clarification on this sentence, and no earlier than 2 months, because the way it's worded, if I plan to be somewhere where I'm not going to be able to get a vaccine in 6 to 12 months, but I'm here today and the interval's been only a week, you could interpret this to say it's okay to give it to me now or at the next visit, which could be next week, which would be far less. So I think stating the minimal interval is going to be important however we do it.
Right, and I understand, and I think we discussed it, and there was a reason why work group members felt that having the minimum interval in the wording might be problematic, and one of the issues that was raised and the way minimum intervals are usually interpreted is if a vaccine is given closer than 8 week interval, then the dose is invalidated and a repeat vaccination is recommended. That's a wording of the minimum interval and the way it was conveyed to us that's how providers interpret the minimum interval. And therefore, we have no data to show that if the vaccine is given, let's say, at 2 days before the 8 week minimum interval, that it should actually be repeated and there's actually any value or no harm in repeating that dose. And therefore, we try to avoid having that 8 week minimum specified in the guidance. And I don't know if others on our work group want to comment, but that was one of the reasons why the minimum interval was not preferred as to be included in the language.
Well, you're seeing if there's anyone who can answer that. I'm aware that there are at least three liaisons lined up for questions. And so if we can start opening up those phone lines.
This is Kemp. I just want to comment briefly. I guess my impression was that the two-month was not optimal because of the increased local reactions and things, so that I felt like we were not saying 2 months was the recommended minimum, although antigenically, you know, it was equal. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely correct about that, that we actually dismissed the 2 months or 8 weeks because of that one study that showed increased reactogenicity. However, anything other than 8 weeks to specify as a minimum interval, I think it was avoided for the reasons that I outlined before, as to not to give an impression that anything less than that has to be invalidated and repeated, therefore.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, this is Nana. If I could just make one comment, if everyone could refer back to slide number 15, it really reviews the considerations for the selection of intervals. And one of the reasons we elected to have the intervals included in the guidance rather than in what we're voting on today was so that we can refine the recommendations about the intervals. So we really want people to be more focused on the recommendations themselves, and then the intervals will be discussed in the guidance.
Excuse me, we do have some questions coming in online. Is it okay to announce those now?
That would be fine.
Okay, our first one comes from David Weber. Your line is now open.
Mr. Weber, Dr. Weber?
I didn't have a question.
Okay. Anybody else?
Our next one comes from Richard Dosky. Your line is now open.
Yes, Dr. Dosky.
Hi, Dr. Tammy. I'm representing AHIP. One of the questions that I have is, have you ensured vaccine supply from the manufacturer if you extend as you're proposing at this point?
Can we ask the liaison manufacturer to comment on this and open the lines, I guess?
If we can figure out how to do that, that would be fine.
And also to remind, I'm being reminded here that they did make a comment about the supply at the last meeting, and they said that there were no issues with the supply, that they anticipated that supply is available for this recommendation if it's made.
And while we have Dr. Dosky on the phone, just a quick question for you. Do you have an idea how many individuals over the age of 65 have coinsurance in which vaccine would be covered?
I don't, but I can try to find that out for you.
That isn't an issue, I think, for at least a handful of people. And those are the people in my practice that typically easily get Zoster coverage because of additional insurance. Thank you. Do we have comment from Pfizer?
Dr. Temke, all participants are on listen only, and they would come in if they queued for star one.
Okay. So... if there are comments, star one needs to be pressed to get the attention of our operator. Is that correct?
That is correct, and it'll take me a minute just to get the names. So would you like a few of the other questions before someone from Pfizer calls in?
That would be fine.
Okay. Our next question comes from Mr. James Lord. Line is now open.
Hi, this is Dr. Jamie Lair. I'm with the AAFP, and I actually have four comments. I'll make them brief. Overall, I find that this is a good idea. I am concerned that the study did not have a comparison with PPSV 23, So the benefit is probably larger than we realize, that they'll probably be, because we are already going to have some people who would just get our normal policy of PPSV 23, and they would have protection from that. I'm also concerned, as a practicing family physician, that I have a 67-year-old in my office who already had PPSV 23 2 years ago, and I can't tell them whether Medicare is going to pay for it, and it's $135, and that's a fairly sizable concern, and they probably won't get it because of the cost. I'm very pleased that the pneumococcal workgroup included a sunset evaluation, because I think it's very pertinent for this. And I also want to comment on the minimum intervals. The implication from the slides that I've seen, when it says 6 to 12 months, based on all the other vaccine recommendations I'm seeing, I'm going to interpret that as a minimal interval. So just people looking at this quickly, the 6 to 12 months is going to become the minimum interval, even if you have it somewhere else in your guidance. That's all.
Thank you very much. If there is somebody on from Pfizer who can comment, please press star 1 to come on to the conference.
John, just to remind folks, I don't know if you can hear me, that they did publicly comment that they anticipate ample supply in all projections and that that should not be a constraint. It's in the minutes from the June meeting.
And I recall that distinctly. Thank you, Dr. Shookup.
I'm still waiting for someone from Pfizer to call in. I do have Kelly Moore on. Ms. Moore, your line is now open.
Dr. Moore, please.
Hi, yes, Dr. Kelly Moore with the Association of Immunization Managers. I'm working with my operational hat on to figure out how immunization programs will best support clinicians implementing this recommendation for the Medicare population. My concern is that the implementation will be extremely good because of the hesitation to administer something that they might not be reimbursed for. We find that to be sometimes a major issue for folks. But I wanted to recheck my understanding following Dr. Shookup's comment. I had thought that PCV 13 is already covered under Medicare Part B because CMS simply pays for a single dose of pneumococcal vaccine regardless of which one, and that the vote today would make explicit our recommendation that one dose should be PCV 13 for those who have zero or unknown doses administered since enrolling in Medicare, which is that 1 in 3 Medicare patients, and that the ACIP recommended second dose would be administered if and when CMS changes its regulations to permit reimbursement for a second dose, and the earliest date being estimated January 2016 for that. And I do want to say that if this is what we need to do to make this happen, I support moving forward so we can get that process underway, but I do urge, like my colleagues, expediting that. I did want to ask, is there any estimate of the risk that the CMS change would not happen, or the risk that the second dose coverage effective date could be delayed well beyond early January 2016? And would this pose any sort of risk for those who got the PCV 13 first and then had a sort of open-ended time for getting the second dose? So what's our confidence around that CMS change? Thank you.
Yeah, Kelly, this is Ann Shookup. Just to say your understanding of the Medicare coverage already being in effect is correct, and if Medicare experts are still on the phone, they could comment on probabilities, but just to defend them, I don't think they're likely to be able to tell you exactly what's going to unfold over the years ahead. There's certainly a Medicare process to update their guidance based on recommendations and new data, so they have ways to do this. The probability and timing is probably unknowable, although if they want to comment, they're welcome to.
Well, this is Allie Kemp. They did earlier, actually. That was exactly my question. They did comment that, unless I'm incorrect, what he said is he couldn't guarantee it, but he thought that the January 2016 was what we should assume would happen, pretty much.
Hi.
Yeah, I heard the term, you know, rapidly and other things, so I was just not sure, depending on the bureaucracy, how likely that was. But hopefully it will be very likely.
Well, I mean, my question was exactly here. Specifically, yeah. Is there a chance that this will not or a reasonable chance this will not happen? Because then what we're doing is changing the order of the vaccine without, you know, we're changing to a different alternative. But I felt pretty reassured by the response.
Okay, but, good.
Yeah, I was too.
We are hitting that point when the orange light starts flashing on the podium that we are nearing the end of our allotted time here. It appears that there is ongoing discussion. I'm wondering if at this point in time there's anyone who is willing to make a motion.
I would be willing to make a motion. This is Nana Bennett. That we accept or that we vote to recommend PC-13 for adults over the age of 65.
And if we can get the slides put up, this would be the proposed language on slide number 30. Which reads, adults 65 years of age or older who have not previously received pneumococcal vaccine or whose previous vaccination history is unknown should receive a dose of PCV-13 first, followed by a dose of PPSV-23.
And, John, we're going to vote on all three together, correct?
I think this would be best as a package, so if we can have slide 31.
Could I just suggest it's important to insert a comma after the word first here?
That would be grammatically correct. Thank you, Art. Okay, slide 31. And correct me if I'm wrong, Nana, but I believe you are saying that in the motion you're making, it would also include adults 65 years of age or older who have not previously received PCV-13 and who have not previously received one or more doses of PPSV-23 should receive a dose of PCV-13.
Yes, and I apologize. My computer was not letting me in at the moment I made the motion, so
and
thank
then,
you.
Then there is a slide 32, correct?
Yes.
And that would be for the potential time-limited utility, which reads, the recommendation for routine PCV-13 use among adults 65 years or older should be re-evaluated in 2018 and revised as needed. Is that, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but
That is my motion.
That is your motion. And to be explicit, we're not making any direct comment on the intervals. Rather, those would be included in the guidance based on discussion we've had already at a number of meetings. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And the wording would also be reviewed by the committee for the intervals.
Okay. Now, do we have a second?
This is Laurie Rubin. I second the motion.
This has been seconded by Dr. Rubin. I believe that we have time for additional comment, and there should be time for public comment as well. So for anyone who is interested in making public comment, to do so, one will have to press star 1 to register the interest in making a comment.
Dr. Tempty, I do have some a group from Pfizer on. Your line is now open.
Thank you.
Yes, hello. Do you hear me?
We can hear you.
Yes, thank you very much. We apologize for this late response. There was some issues with the phone. I'm Luis Joder. I'm the head of vaccines medical for Pfizer. We just want to have a quick comment about the language of the proposed recommendations if voted today. We are a bit concerned about the sunset clause that specifically mentions a date, the 2018. I think as the discussion has progressed, we all agreed that evaluating the effectiveness of the vaccine and the health protective effect on a regular basis is warranted. However, putting a date and considering the low immunization rates for adults and the difficulties to increase uptake, we were wondering if the group is not worried that this might hamper a group of healthcare professionals to wait until 2018. So we just were wondering whether you really need to specify a 2018. That would be unprecedented, and it seems to us that a constant reevaluation of the effectiveness and health protection is being done on a regular basis anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comment out there?
I do have some questions coming in from the public. Are those okay to go ahead and start with?
Yes, please.
All right. Our first question is from Bob Blancato. Your line is now open.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I was present at your June 26th meeting, and I'm just going to repeat a couple of the quick points. I represent the National Association of Nutrition and Aging Service Programs. Our folks serve older people daily with meals in homes and community centers. And we strongly associate ourselves with your comments of a broader use of pneumococcal vaccine in adults, especially older adults. We are very concerned that we are having too few people taking advantage of the of getting the vaccine. We are sensitive to the issue about Medicare and hope that your vote today can lead to expedited activity on the part of Medicare for expanding coverage. But our concern is, you know, is a very basic one. You know, if someone comes to our program and has the flu and it can spread rapidly, it creates a major problem in our day-to-day operations. So on behalf of those people who serve older people on a daily basis, we applaud your work and your efforts here, and we hope the vote comes out in a way that allows for broader use of this vaccine. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment.
Our next question or comment comes from Virginia Ladd. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to reiterate my comments that I made earlier this summer, and that is I represent the American Autoimmune-Related Diseases Association, so we represent about 50 million Americans with autoimmune disease, many of whom have immune compromise either by therapy or by disease. And I'd just like to reiterate for this population, herd immunization is a very important factor because they are immune compromised or they're taking immune compromising therapies. So I just want to reiterate the importance of that while you consider voting.
Thank you very much.
Our next question or comment comes from Alice Knapp. Your line is now open.
And if we can, as our other speakers, your name and any affiliation, please.
Hi, my name is Alice Knapp. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I am just a registered nurse with one of the county health departments in Florida. And I was wondering if you could go back to the first slide on this proposal that you're making. And I don't have any questions. I just would like to see it again.
And that would be, I believe, slide 30, if I'm...
That's it. That's all I wanted. Thank you.
And thank you.
Our next question or comment comes from Dr. Malcone. You're from Merck. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I wanted to make two points. The first, I wanted to make sure that the committee is aware that there may be some limitations on manufacturers' ability to discuss this kind of sequential vaccination, these kinds of dosing intervals, since they're not aligned with what's in the label for either vaccine, I believe. And I wonder if our colleague from FDA might want to comment on that. And then, you know, many issues around implementation have been raised today. I personally am very concerned about those. I think we should really look at how well we have done at completing series of vaccines once you get outside of the pediatric population. And I think, unfortunately, our track record as a nation is not very encouraging in that regard. So I'm very concerned that people will get one vaccine and that will be it. So I just want to make sure that point is very clearly called out for you all to consider.
I'm wondering if Dr. Wellington Sun is on, who could comment on the FDA licensure and the aspect of one vaccine followed by another, which may not be on the product insert.
Yeah, hi, this is Wellington. I'm not clear on what our Merck representative is referring to in terms of alignment with the label. I was wondering if you can clarify his comment as to which label and which particular part of that label is the concern.
Sure. I think the concern is that a sequential vaccination, as has been contemplated here, is not explicitly listed on our label, and therefore, were we to speak to that we would be doing some kind of off-label promotion. And I presume the same would be true for Pfizer as well.
Well, the particular label in question for the Prevnar 13 and for your polysaccharide vaccine makes no reference to in their indication or schedule for the other vaccine. So I don't think this would necessarily preclude exact recommendation. And further, I think because the particular sponsors have conducted studies using their own vaccines, and sometimes you don't make particular claims about use of other licensed vaccines or competitors' vaccines. So I don't see that as a problem. I think here it's a matter of public health with the ACI to make particular recommendations of licensed FDA vaccines.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sun. Does that answer the question?
Yes, I think Dr. Sun did provide his opinion on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, other comment?
I show no more questions or comments in queue at this time.
Thank you very much. Other discussion from ACIP members? It sounds fairly quiet. We have a motion on the table. We have a second. And last chance for any comment.
No? John, this is Larry. Do you want to repeat that? Because there's been a lot of discussion after the motions were made. Maybe you can repeat the motion so everyone is crystal clear about what it is.
Okay. Is very appropriate. I'm going to go back to slide number 30. And for people who don't have the benefit of the slides in front of them, the motion as it stands and has been seconded is as follows. For adults age 65 years and older with no previous pneumococcal vaccine of either PCV13 or PPSV23, the proposed language is adults 65 years of age or older who have not previously received pneumococcal vaccine or whose previous vaccination history is unknown should receive a dose of PCV13 first, comma, followed by a dose of PPSV23. Slide 32, or 31, sorry. And this applies to PCV13 naive adults age 65 years and older, who have previously been vaccinated with PPSV23, proposed language is adults 65 years of age or older who have not previously received PCV13 and who have previously received one or more doses of PPSV23 should receive a dose of PCV13. And then slide 32, the third component. This is potential time-limited utility of routine PCV13 use among adults age 65 years and older. Proposed language, the recommendations for routine PCV13 use among adults age 65 years or older should be reevaluated in 2018 and revised as needed. Any final clarifying questions?
Hey, John, this is Doug.
Yeah, Dr. Campos-Holcote.
Yeah, could you explain to me your comment at the beginning of this call about abstentions? Because I'm not aware that we have any rules that prevent us from doing that.
No, we do not have any rules for abstentions. It's more procedurally that traditionally we try and minimize abstentions and go for either an up or down vote and usually utilize abstentions in situations where there's a conflict of interest. That being said, within the ACIP charter and other rules of order, there is no direct limitation. Does that clarify?
Yeah, thanks.
Any other question? Okay. With that, and given that we have a full quorum, I will ask for a vote, and I'm going to have to read the names, and we're going to start middle of the alphabet and go backwards. We're unable to do clockwise or counterclockwise here, but I'm going to call on Dr. Lee Harrison to start the voting.
Yes.
Dr. Harrison?
Yes.
Yes. Dr. Harriman?
Yes.
Dr. Campos-Holcote?
No.
Okay. Dr. Bocchini?
Bocchini, yes.
Dr. Bennett?
Yes.
Dr. Belongia?
No.
Dr. Vasquez?
Vasquez, yes.
I think I'm next. Dr. Tempty, yes. Dr. Rubin?
Rubin, yes.
Dr. Romero?
Romero, yes.
Dr. Riley?
Riley, yes.
Dr. Reingold?
Reingold, yes.
Ms. Pellegrini?
Pellegrini, yes.
Dr. Kemp?
Kemp, yes.
And Dr. Curran?
Curran, yes.
I think I successfully navigated this. We have 13 votes for. We have 2 votes against. The motion passes. Are there additional comments from any of the ACIP members or from our ex officios or from the Secretariat? Or from CDC?
This is Nana Bennett. I just want to thank everyone. I know this was a huge amount to ask from both the CDC staff and from the ACIP members. And we are the work group is very grateful for all of your hard work and for allowing this meeting to occur.
Yes, we greatly appreciate all the efforts from CDC staff. We appreciate the efforts of the Secretariat in helping to organize and operationalizing what's a difficult thing to do over phone and through the web meetings. We also appreciate, I think we maxed out at one time at about 530 attendees online. And we also appreciate the liaisons and especially the ACIP members who have taken a large amount of time out of their day for this. And with that, Dr. Pickering, do you have additional comment?
No, I agree, John. The figure you quoted can be upped a little bit to 1,142 were people online. So this was a very important and interesting vote for everyone. Hopefully the majority of people will be happy. And, again, thanks to everybody. This is a real combined effort by a lot of high-quality people, and we're sincerely grateful.
And if I can make one final comment, I still feel very strongly that, you know, with our adult, especially our older adults, this is a very large problem in terms of a vaccine-preventable disease. And regardless of the vaccine we're using, we still are greatly underutilizing this, not only for our adults over the age of 65, but also for those younger adults with ongoing medical indications. So at least I think this provides a signal that we take the health care of and prevention in our older adults seriously, and we strive to do the best thing we can for them. But I thank everybody for their time, their attention, and wish you a very good rest of the day.
Thanks.
Cheers.
This does conclude.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Participants may disconnect now.